No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR, and we'd love to hear from you. Tonight we have a special guest, Chuck Hicks, and we'll bring him on in a moment. Chuck's been on the show before, and he's just a wonderful person, and he's going to talk about the Martin Luther King holiday coming up and civil rights and some other important stuff. But first, let me introduce the birthday girl, Maria Sanchez. You had another birthday. What's it?
I did.
You're 39 now?
Yes, I am, again.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 39 and holding, right?
Happy birthday, Maria.
Thank you.
My favorite co-host. And let me say, before we get started, that our cup run is over. You know, we had 150-some co-sponsors introduce our bill. We're now up to 182 in the House, and we've got 8 new co-sponsors just this week since we talked last. So let me say thank you to Representative Stephen Horsford from Nevada's 4th, Kurt Schrader from Oregon's 5th, Ed Case from Hawaii's 1st District, Tom Malinowski from New Jersey's 7th, James Crow from Jason Crow from Colorado's 6th District, Lori Trahan from Massachusetts 3rd, Andy Kim again from New Jersey, yay, my home state, and Debbie McCarcel Powell, I'm sorry, I'm sure I'm massacring her name, McCarcel Powell from Florida's 26th District. Thank you all for your support of D.C. statehood. We're now up to 182 co-sponsors in the House, the most we've ever had. So, yeah.
Like by a lot, the most.
Yeah, by a lot. Yeah, by a lot. And we're talking about introducing a bill in the Senate, a companion bill, in the next few weeks. And we want to do it with more co-sponsors than we've ever had on that bill, too. So by the time that gets introduced, we'll be way up into the, you know, probably 220s. So we're excited about that.
So, Michael, have you ever solicited a petition from ordinary citizens?
Yes. Oh, yes. We actually had a referendum on the ballot in 2016, which 84% of the voters supported. In addition to that, yes, over the years, we've done petitions and submitted petitions. Now, we've never done a petition drive in somebody else's state, which is interesting, you know.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Because I'm sorry to interrupt, but on the eve of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, they solicited a petition to Congress that had 6 million signatures, and that helped create the holiday.
Yes, I'm sure it absolutely did.
Well, think
and that's
about it.
Probably
how powerful is
what
that?
It's, you know, our big problem, Maria, is money. They don't put money into this. So, you know, if I go to the city and say, you know, we'd like to go solicit signatures in Nevada, they'd say, go ahead, good luck. You know what I mean? I mean, you don't get 6 million signatures unless you have money to put into a petition drive. We just recently got marijuana legalized in the district, and they got, I forget how many signatures, 35, 40,000 signatures in the District of Columbia. But they paid people to go out and do it, and they organized them, and they trained them. And that's kind of what you need to do, and that would be great to go into a state. Obviously, we don't have to come to California because you people are jumping on the train right and left. God bless you. But you know,
I would argue, Michael, you don't have to do it the old-fashioned way, just like you don't have to do white mail anymore. You do something on moveon.org or something else.
Well, we have a petition on moveon.org. But
for statehood?
Yes, but our petition on moveon.org has been on for 3 years, and I think I have 2,200 signatures at this point, or 2,300 signatures.
So we'll talk offline, because obviously that needs to be freshened.
Yeah, because we need to somehow supplement that so more people sign on. But that's a great idea. And if you're out there, folks, go to our MoveOn petition and sign on. MoveOn.org, you can find it, Petition for D.C. Statehood. Or you can go to our website, dcstatehood.org, and you can sign the petition there. But, yes, I'd love to get 6 million signatures and hand them in. And they tell you what states they're from, too, so that's handy.
Right.
Because, you know, if you get a million from Connecticut, we could finally get Chris Murphy, who we've been on his rear end for years. We could probably finally get him, so that would be great. Well, without any further ado, let me bring my dear friend and just a great guy. We call him Mr. Black History. He knows more about the history of Washington, D.C. and the Civil Rights Movement than anybody else I know. And he's graciously agreed to come on the eve of our Martin Luther King Day parade in Anacostia tomorrow. So, Chuck Hicks, without further ado, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming back on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Chuck, let's start with the holiday. You know, Maria, first of all, Maria tells me something I've never known before, that we had 6 million, million signatures on a petition to make it a holiday. And it's a holiday everywhere but Arizona. I don't know why the people of Arizona aren't on board, but they never have been. But tell us, Chuck, why do you think this holiday is so important to America?
Well, you know, I think there are a couple of things. And first of all, let me interject that the first place that it became a holiday in this country was the District of Columbia. And that was put through the city council. The bill was introduced by Philomena Roloff from Ward 8, and that was the first place. But I think this holiday has become and is important because Dr. King represented, I think, what lots of people would like to feel as a hope for America, that there is a great need for love and understanding and equality for everybody. And Dr. King stood for that. Right from the beginning, when he got involved in the civil rights movement, he was very, very inclusive with everybody involved in the civil rights movement. Oftentimes, there are different groups who sort of took one philosophy, tried to stay within the black community, but Dr. King had an understanding of the importance of his life, his belief about mankind. That everybody was equal, and everybody needed to be treated equal, and that to make this happen, we all had to be in this fight together. And as he stood steadfast with that belief, even in a time when his popularity dropped in African-American community, he would not change his belief. He stood on what he thought was the right thing to do and the right way in terms of how he saw America and how he saw the world. He started off in the civil rights movement, being involved in the struggle for opportunities for African Americans, from voting rights to social justice issues, to economic issues, to education. But as he stayed in this movement, he eventually expanded his belief or his ideas.
Well, you know, I've got to say that that's the thing, Chuck, that I respect most about him, is that God was always in the center of his work, you know, and he absolutely never changed, you know, and they say his favorite quote from the Bible was Amos, let justice roll down like water and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream, you know, and that's really the way he lived his life, wasn't it? You know, that he wanted justice to cover everybody, and he wanted justice to be everywhere, you know, not just for one group or another. And yeah, that's absolutely true. All you have to do is read his letter from a Birmingham jail to know that he never wavered in that belief. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It didn't hurt that he was an orator and charismatic and comfortable in front of great groups of people and told a story like no others. So studying media psychology, we studied his I Have a Dream speech, and it's recognized as the best speech ever given. And we actually dissected it and analyzed it, and it was what is, what could be, what is, what could be. And it goes into a crescendo. I mean, it gives me goosebumps just to talk about it, let alone to listen to it. I've listened to it over and over and over. And he was just gifted. I mean, not only was he passionate and did he have America's best interests in mind, but he was more than talented. And you got to figure that's God talent, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I think one of the interesting things about that speech is that, as you say, it was what if and what is. But it was a very, very simple speech. It was very flowery. You could see. It was a speech that you could see and people could identify with, people who had and people who didn't have, people who wanted to see something different. So it was a speech that he made you see what he was saying. He made you feel what he was talking about. When he talked about children, little children, black children, and brown children, and white children holding hands, you can see that. You can see those kinds of things.
Yes, he painted beautiful images.
You know, that was part of his genius, right? And
and
I unfortunately believe that we have lost touch with that in the Democratic Party for you know, I think that we talk down to people, unfortunately, and that's something that King didn't do. King related to people, as you said, Chuck, on all different levels, and all different types of people related to him. And you know, I think the most amazing thing about him was that when he was assassinated, he was only 39 years old. You know, he changed the world before he reached 40. Mm-hmm. Obviously.
And that's a very interesting thing because, well, 2 points right quick. Number one, sometimes King's speeches, he made himself humble. And one of the speeches that does that is the drum major. When he talks about the drum major, and that he wanted to help people. He wanted to be the kind of person that helped people. He just didn't want to be a drum major. He just wanted to be in the band helping people that made a difference. King was also very, very mindful as he was a brilliant spiritual man, and I think he thought a lot. And as he thought, he began to grow. He grew amazingly in his less than 40 years here, because he started off from a spiritual standpoint about a group of people who were suffering and mistreated. And, of course, that was African-Americans, that the plight that African-Americans had been under since the Civil War. And then as he got involved in this, and the more he got involved and began to look around and study, he saw that there was a much bigger problem, a much bigger challenge. And that was a challenge for all people, that there was a challenge for poor people. When he made his speech, No More Vietnam, in New York, that was a major step forward for him. And it was a major step because it was a big risk. And then that, when making that, no more Vietnam speech coming out against the war in Vietnam, of course, that was a, the African-American community was still in the middle of civil rights. And when King took the position, and knowing that more blacks were being killed, were fortunately in Vietnam than whites, and to come out against the war, many people, particularly in the South, things were surprised and frustrated that we were still in the battlefield, on the battlefield in small southern towns and in places throughout the South, trying to get voter rights, trying to get decent jobs, trying to get education. And here he is moving out into a new area that was not where the black community was at. As a matter of fact, his popularity in African-American community began to drop substantially. And, you know, by the time King was assassinated, he was at an all-time low in terms of support for an African-American community, because he had not only moved from the war in Vietnam, but he had moved to the campaign of hunger in America, poor people. It was a poor people's campaign. It wasn't a black people's campaign. It was a poor people campaign. It was about poor people being hungry in this country, poor people needing jobs, poor people needing to be educated. And so it was a major, major shift that he had taken on. And at the time he was assassinated, he was at his own time. Well, after he was assassinated, he became a martyr. He just grew his stature. But one of the reasons is an interesting thing, because he was trying to stay connected to the African-American community. And, of course, in Tennessee, where they had the sanitation march, where those sanitation drivers, where there was a storm, and they were in that trash can, and they got the machine came on, and they got crushed and killed. And he went to Memphis the first time for a march, and the march fell apart. And a couple of weeks, a month later, so he was on his way to D.C. to do the poor, to start to kick off the Poor People's Campaign. And there was a big push for him to come back to Memphis to lead that march. And so at the last minute, he changed his plan and decided to come to Memphis. And the interesting thing about that is that he was getting a lot of feedback and fallout, because when King first started as a minister of rights leader, when they came to Magnolia, Mississippi, they stayed with the reverend of some back church, or they stayed with the church clerk or somebody. But they stayed in small in people's houses and things. As King's popularity grew, he ended up, if he came someplace, he stayed in another city. He stayed in Jackson. He didn't stay in Sunflower, Mississippi. And there was complaints about him, his disconnect, in terms of as he grew in popularity. And so he chose to stay. They had reservation for him someplace else, but he chose to stay at the Lorraine Motel. Yeah. And that was because he wanted to stay connected. He did not want to lose his connection with African-American community, even though he saw that as a part of his fight. And he saw it as that this wasn't just a black people's fight. While we were oppressed, it might have been the focus of all these. There were other people who were oppressed also, and so he was in a turmoil. It was not an easy struggle for him, as it was not for many civil rights leaders to try to keep your focus on the people you were leading, but having the foresight to understand that this fight, this battle, is much bigger than where it is, where we are today. But it's got to grow, it's got to be bigger. Go ahead.
He was in Memphis for the striking garbage workers, right?
Right, right.
So it wasn't a race issue. It was, like you said, about the poor or the oppressed.
Right, but he was on his way to Washington, D.C. to kick off the Poor People's Campaign. But because he had been to Memphis and the march didn't turn out well, there was a lot of pressure on him to come back there. So he agreed to come back. He changed his plan and agreed to come back to Memphis and leave that march. And what happened was, he was not supposed to speak the night. He was to stay in that hotel and rest and get up and speak. And the rally went on, and the people, his lieutenants came back and say, "Martin, they want to hear you. You got to come speak." And he didn't want to get up and go, but he got up, and that's when he gave that speech. I may not be, we may not all get here. With the life, the longevity, we all won't run, but I'm not afraid. I've been to the mountain. I've seen the other side. That's when he gave that speech, and that was an unprepared speech. But
want to get goosebumps, if you want to get goosebumps, you should read that speech, because it's amazing. And I truly believe in my heart that this is a man that talked directly to God. He saw the vision.
Right.
Yeah. He did see the vision.
But like I say, he was not headed to Memphis. He was headed to D.C. to start the Poor People's Campaign.
Well, let me ask you, Chuck, since you bring it up, there was an incident on the... I think we all know about it now. We saw it on the internet. There was an incident yesterday at the, or the day before yesterday, at the Lincoln Memorial, right where King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, where young people made fun from a high school, made fun of, intimidated a Native American named Nathan Phillips, who was an Omaha elder and a Vietnam vet, and they tried to intimidate him. Now, the Catholic Archdiocese has come out today saying that these children will be punished, that there'll be an investigation, that it's really not, we should add that it's not what the Catholic Church stands for, and that these kids acted inappropriately. But what do you think of that, Chuck? Are we going back on civil rights these days? I don't think
we can sit down and think things are going to happen if we don't continue to educate, we don't continue to have dialogue with each other, if we don't continue to work together and understand that our struggles, one struggle is everybody's struggle, that we have to educate our young people so that they don't fear. You know, there are lots of people who fear that they're going to lose something. If we do the Dream Act, I feel that they're going to lose out. We have to remind people that this country is big enough to take care of everybody. There should be nobody in this country offered. There should be jobs for everybody, and that everybody has a chance, should have a chance in this country. But there are those who believe their privileges, and perhaps the privilege of being white is going to be taken away. And that's a really serious problem in this country, the privilege of being white and the fear of losing it.
I turned to our resident psychologist, Maria, but that's really what fuels aggressive behavior, isn't it? Fear, isn't it?
Yes.
What's at the root of it? Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
One of the things that you can look at and talk about that, I can remember back when Emmett Till was killed, and back in those days when poor whites didn't oftentimes have enough as blacks in a town, and that could be black doctors or insurance men or black businessmen in that community, and they could have a suit on and dress well. But when they walked down the street in that little town, and those poor whites were on that street, blacks had to get off the sidewalk just for them because they were white. Not that they were economically better. They didn't have what the black had, but they had the privilege of being white, as poor as they were. And that is a serious problem, that people feel that they are going to lose that privilege.
You know,
it's funny because it's not
a zero-sum game. As Louise Hay, who passed away, she's a former psychologist, she says, everybody has a garden hose into the ocean of life. Your garden hose isn't going to take away from anybody else's experience.
Right.
And that's what I don't understand, is it's not, if it's you, then it's not me. It can be us.
Right.
Well, and you know, we see this. I mean, now Maria's a parent. Her children are a little older than mine. But, you know, one thing I see in my children's generation is a sense of privilege that we never had. We didn't have as much of as kids. This generation really does feel entitled. They, you know, and if I could change one thing about this generation, it would be that sense. You know, at least we were brought up with some sense that you had to do, you know, that America was a place where if you worked hard and you accomplished certain things, got an education, did other things, that you could succeed. Now, you know, I think there's this sense that America needs to give you something. You know, you don't need to work for it. You need to be given.
Well, part of the problem is the parents who hovered, the helicopter parents, they didn't want Johnny to have to face failure or lose or keep score or everybody gets a trophy. I mean, that contributes to the narcissism that this entitlement speaks to, and I'm not diagnosing a whole generation, but if you set your children up to expect that that's what life is going to deal you, then how can you blame them? And they have to be re-educated, and it's going to be the school of hard knocks, I'm afraid.
As Chuck points out, you know, and look, I was the bench warmer when I was a kid. I warmed the bench, and it was hard. It was hard to see all my other friends get to play, and I come to all the practices and you know, not get to play. But you know what? It developed in me a personality where I didn't try at sports anymore. I went and did other things, you know? I tried to become the most popular kid in other ways. I was a class clown. I was the, you know, the this or that. But you know, maybe that's important. Maybe you should know if you're not going to be a great athlete. Maybe you should know that right up front. You're not going to be a great athlete. Instead of clapping for, you know, we went out there and clapped. If they touched the ball, we clapped. So I think you're right, Maria. But far be it from me to diagnose a whole generation. So where do we go from here, Chuck? We're going to have a big parade tomorrow in Anacostia.
Well,
Senator Brown's going to be freezing his rear end off. Where do we go from here?
I think we go from here with the belief that we all have something that we can do to make this country, make this world a better place. And that one of the things, lessons that I think that we learned, many of us during the civil rights movement, was that there were different roles that everybody played. And what became important was to find your niche, that everybody can't be, everybody could march. But there were people who couldn't march, but they could write a check. There were people who couldn't write a check, but when you came in from a march, they had made a big pot of collard greens and cornbread. And so everybody found a way in terms of making a contribution to the struggle. And I think that holds true today, that people look around and we figure out, and whatever it is, that we need to be aware that that all of us can make a difference in this struggle, in this world. Be it that some of us take our time out and help a senior citizen every once in a while. Write a letter, knock on the door to see, I'm going to the grocery store. Is there something I can do for you? That we need to continue to believe that we can share care about each other. We might have different views about everything, but there is a sense of understanding that we can grow and have dialogue and learn to talk about what's different and learn to talk about how we can work together. And that it's not, and that sometimes we stand on principle. But we stand on principle because it's the right thing to do and not because we are so much against you, but the principle says, and we believe in the rights that every human being, that there are certain kinds of lifestyles and certain kinds of ways of living. And I think we don't give up on that. And I think Dr. King continued to do that and believe in that. And so many other people who marched during the civil rights movement, for people who are marching today for the Me Too movement, for all those movements who are coming of age today, who are saying that there is still problems that we must face. And we're going to face them together, and we're going to figure out how we can make it better. We're going to talk about it, but we're not going to stand by and let things happen. And then sometimes, you know, I think it's a hard thing to do, but sometimes I think it's important that we take that step. When we see something wrong, we say, hey, don't do that. Hey, you know, my cousin is disabled. And so don't make fun of that guy. I got a cousin like that. And so we need to sometimes stand up and take a stand and not let people do something. If we don't say anything, then people continue to think they can do whatever they want to do. But sometimes just saying to somebody, not bullying them, not confronting them, but just saying gently, hey, you know, that's not very nice, you know. You might have somebody in that situation. And so we gotta show some human kindness. You know, part of this struggle we still need to have some human kindness in it. And the struggle is not going to happen overnight. And people get discouraged because they think everything should be all right now. But it's not. It hadn't been, but we can make it better.
To that end, though, Chuck, why don't you promote your website? Because it's filled with information, and especially this week and then next month for Black History Month.
Yeah, please do that.
Well, we will be putting out our Black History calendar along with the city of the things that we're doing. We're redoing our website, but I'll be able to announce that on a couple of radio stations. I'll give it to Senator Brown. But also, we have a number of programs that we're doing this year to talk about talking, learning to talk to each other. And of course, our Black History kickoff will be February 1st at the African American Civil War Museum. And tomorrow is a big day, and we have over 100 entries of people who want to be in that parade and march. And we went to the meeting Saturday, and we talked about the coldness, and we got warming stations and places that people will be able to stop off and warm if they get too cold. But the amazing thing was that out of the 100 entries that we had to be in the parade, we only had three groups who said they could not be a part of it. One of them was the Anacostia Steel Band because they can't play in cold weather. But we were still getting requests also for people who said they still wanted to be a part of this parade. So I think that makes a statement about D.C. I think that makes a statement about people who believe that there's hope that we can do some things that will make things better in this city.
I love your message. It's so optimistic.
I think that's true, Chuck, and thanks for being at the center of that. And one thing that you just said that really strikes me is that how we have to make this personal. You know, I said a few weeks ago on the show with Maria, with the passing of George Bush Sr., that I think, again, this is something that we've lost. George Bush Sr. was a guy that I worked against when I worked for Michael Dukakis. But I also had great respect for this man, for who he was, for the fact that he was a patriotic American, that he had given so much to our country in terms of service. We didn't agree, but I had great respect for him. And I think this is something that we've lost, that you're a Democrat, so I know all about you. You're a Republican, so I know all about you. You're this or that. You know, we take these labels and we don't take it down to a personal level anymore. You know, we see that people in New York City, for example, are seen as being aggressive and, you know, they have a reputation for not being the most polite people in the world. But we saw when we had that tragedy on 9/11 how they all pulled together and how when it became personal for them, they all reached out to each other. And I think that this is a really important thing. I think we really need, I agree with you 100%.
You know,
we need to make it personal.
I believe in the goodness of man, and I believe that there are more good people than there are bad people. And one of the good ways is to look at this is perhaps tomorrow, but also whenever, you know, one of the things you can look at is when we have a bad snow and everything is snowed under. Look how nice people are to each other. They really are.
Really? The adversity brings out the kindness?
Yeah, well, this is something Maria can't relate to because she lives in Southern California.
That is true.
They have their share of disasters, but they don't have snow.
That is
but
awesome.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And the other thing that brings people out is during the holiday season of Christmas. People seem to be more nicer to each other. They want to say hello. They'll say Merry Christmas. They'll say Happy Holidays. There is a different spirit that people want to have. They want to be around, and they want to give out a certain kind of spirit. And so it's not. I don't know how we cannot continue to carry that. But there are Puritan times when the goodness of us come out. And then, like you said, when there are adversities. I look now at what's going on with the shutdown. And I am so impressed with people who are doing all kinds of little things to help people who are not working and who are not getting paid. I was looking, they had something on that just this morning where there were two sisters who are making cheesecakes and selling them. And they're buying gas cards and giving them to people so they can get back and forth because they're not being paid. There's all kinds of wonderful efforts that people are coming together to help people who are not working. And,
yes,
and you don't normally see that, but people think that we can identify with people not getting a paycheck. Many of us are just a paycheck away. Or two paychecks away, and some of us are just a half a paycheck away. But we can also identify that that when you don't have food in your house, or when you don't have enough money to put gas in your tank to go get to someplace or pick up your children from school, that those things become important. And we know that those are the little things that we can do in this city and throughout the country that will make a difference in people, and people will remember that they were in a community where people turn them out and say, let me see what I can do to help during this time of crisis. And that's very, very important.
You know, it's absolutely true that Americans are the most generous people on the face of the planet. Although our government doesn't give as much in charitable contributions as some other countries, the people of the United States give more money per capita than anybody in the world to charity. So we're very, very generous people. And yeah, again, Chuck, you bring up a really great, really important point when you talk about the government shutdown, because, you know, these are people that we normally complain about that we're helping, right? I mean, I'm a recreational sailor. I go out and I complain about the Coast Guard all the time, but thank God they're there. Right, and at a time like this, it brings it in perspective, and we you know, we empathize because we say these are important people. You know,
I'd like to ask, Michael.
Is this because
it must inordinately be affecting the District of Columbia? Are you living in a ghost town?
We are, to a certain extent. I mean, you can drive down Constitution Avenue where you normally can't find a parking space because all the Smithsonians are there, Independence Avenue, and now it's vacant. And yes, and the District of Columbia is actually picking up millions and millions of dollars a week in costs that would normally be picked up by the federal government. And our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and our mayor have said that we are going to petition the government, the federal government, to be reimbursed for the money that we've had to spend, the extra money that we've had to spend. But, yeah, it is very much like it's not a ghost town because we have so many other things that go on in this city. But,
sometimes people can see it,
and we're feeling the effect of it.
Sometimes people don't realize how many people come into this city every day to work. You know, we bring in 300,000 people a day easily to come to work here. Rush hour starts for us at 4:30 in the morning. People start coming to work at 4:30 in the morning, even sometimes when they don't need to be to work at 7 o'clock because of traffic and where they live.
Well, because I had heard that you swell to 2.5 million a day.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of folks that come into the district.
Yeah.
Well, 35% of the daytime population of the District of Columbia is only made up by 35% of the people that live here. And we have 708,000 residents.
Okay.
So during the daytime, we're only 35% of the population. At nighttime, we're 100% of the population. But,
right.
Yeah, there's a lot. And they're saying, you know, things that you might not think right off the top of your head, like Metro, which is our rail system, is losing millions of dollars a week, you know, because ridership is so far down. So many people take the Metro system. Almost a million people a day ride Metro, and it's way down. So those things
well,
are down.
Well, we hear, too,
and then, of course, all the little businesses.
Yeah,
all the little businesses. Yeah, all the restaurants and bars and the little businesses, you know, local businesses that cater to the lunchtime crowd and
right
and, you
or
know,
dry cleaners or yeah. I'd imagine drugstores and grocery
and
stores
and all the trucks yep. who line the street and people yep. eat in.
Yeah,
they've been affected.
Well, and you know, a lot of these businesses are also. Pay period to pay period. So after a month, it's been almost a month now, they're really hurting. You know, they may not be able to make the payment on that food truck next month or the rent on a restaurant. You know, I don't think some people realize how close these businesses are how minor their profits are in terms of how much it costs them to run the business. And a few percentage points makes a world of difference to a lot of these people. So,
especially in the food industry.
There's
not a lot of markup there. They need volume.
Right.
All right. And Senator Brown, before I forget, let me not forget to make a plug for the Peace Walk that will happen before the parade. And the Peace Walk is the walk that people have done for a number of years now, because there's so much crime in Ward 7 and 8, but throughout the city. And people come together and they walk for peace, not only in Ward 7 and 8, but throughout the city. And one of the things that we do that's not publicized as part of the Martin Luther King Parade Committee is that every year we have a private dinner for families who have lost people in violence for that year. Not only mothers, but families. If you lost your brother or your cousin, we invite those families to a private dinner. It's not a public thing. And we try to show some support for those people and let them know we understand their sorrow and their loss. That one of the things that Peace Walk also tries to remind people that it's more than just when you kill somebody, a whole circle of people are affected when you take someone's life on both sides of the fence. Now, on your side, when you've done it, your family is ostracized and talked about, and they got to go through changes, just like those who have lost a loved one. And so it's a big circle, and that Peace Walk is important because they come in and people talk about peace, they talk about returning citizens, they talk about the fight for statehood. They talk about a lot of different issues here in the city, and they march for that. And so it's important that if people would like to be a part of that, that they can be a part of that Peace Walk. And
that's when is it?
The Peace Walk starts at 10 o'clock.
But when?
Down at right across
tomorrow.
The Atlanta Conference
Station.
Oh,
it's tomorrow.
So we do the Peace Walk first, and then the parade kicks off at 12 o'clock and goes down on Martin Luther King Avenue. But the Peace Walk is, we have hundreds and hundreds of people who with signs and different groups and throughout the city, community and the city who march for peace in the city. And as a right across from the Anacostia Station is where the rally, the Peace Walk begins. And they march to enjoy the parade, and then we merge together and march in the parade. So I want for everybody to make sure that if you're available, come on out to the Peace Walk.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is one of the wonderful things about this, Maria, is that this event is organic. You know, it really, really stems from a handful of people like Chuck Hicks, who are on this parade committee, who are local organizers who put this together. I've been part of the committee in past years, and it's just a group of local people that sit around a table and put all this together. And as Chuck said, tomorrow in the parade there'll be more than 125 groups involved. And it's really, really a lovely event where everybody comes out. So if you're a Washingtonian, please come out to the Peace March, the Peace Walk. If you're sturdy enough to take it, we're going to have temperatures in the teens tomorrow. But and if not, at least come out to the march. It's a couple of hours, and it's a great way to pay tribute to a great man who led us all, in my humble opinion, in the right direction, and also a good way to stay involved. You know, there's also things going around all over Washington, and I'm sure all over the country, where people are doing community service tomorrow in honor of Dr. King, because that was Dr. King's one of his messages, right, that we all had to be engaged. And you know,
and
if you're
Senator,
in your community,
if you don't
do
mind, all 50 states do now recognize and celebrate MLK Junior Day.
Including Arizona?
Yes, Arizona. Yeah. Because even Utah and South Carolina were after Arizona.
They
had a petition on their ballot in 1993, I think it was, and so they voted it in. So, and that he received the Nobel Peace Prize at the age of 35, the youngest man ever.
Well, so yeah. I stand corrected and apologize to the people of Arizona. All you did was drag your feet a little bit, I guess. But thank God that we all celebrate this great man, because his message is important for all of us. So, Chuck, we're getting towards the end of our show, so tell us something that you wanted to say that we haven't asked you, or you know, make a final comment. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, first of all, I would urge everybody, if you did nothing more, then take a minute and think about what Dr. King has done, what he means to somebody, and just be nice to somebody tomorrow. You know, Dr. King had a heart that was full of goodness. And we find different ways to be nice, but there's a way that we all can be nice. We can all make a difference in somebody's life just by doing a nice smile, by saying hello, or how are you, just simple things. And make a world of difference to people. And so I would urge people to just be nice to somebody. And we can all do that. It doesn't cost us anything. It doesn't cost us a cent. Just a smile or a nice, well, how are you today? Can I help you cross the street? Makes a world of difference to make this world a better place.
I love that you say that, because I've always felt that way, and I thought maybe it's because I'm Pollyanna or glass half full, or I've always been optimistic. And here you've been in the trenches for decades and decades, and yet you're still sharing that message, which should give us all hope.
Oh yeah, we got to believe it. And if we ever, you know, we can never give up. We can never get up.
Let me tell you, I've had the honor and privilege of knowing this man, Chuck Hicks, personally. And this is really, it's not just something he says, it's something he lives. He's one of the nicest people that you ever want to meet. And, you know, we often say in Washington, D.C. that if you talk the talk, you have to walk the walk. And Chuck Hicks is certainly a man that does both and has spent his whole life doing that. And we so much appreciate you coming on today, Chuck. And I hope to see you.
I appreciate you having me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I hope to see you at the parade tomorrow. It's going to be cold. I hurt my foot, so I'm not walking this year for the first time. I'm going to be in a car, and you're welcome. You're welcome to be with us, Chuck, if you need a warm place to sit.
I'll be at the reviewing stand, so come on up so you can make some remarks.
Okay.
We'll bring you up and have you make a couple of remarks.
All right. Thank you.
And do we want to mention the dcblackhistory.com website, or you don't want to promote it until you revamp it?
I will get it out, and Senator Brown will have it. We're redoing it. I'm not sure what the new website is going to be,
Okay.
But you can always reach me. My email is MrBlackHistory@yahoo.com.
And we'll have you back on when you get the website up, and we'll talk about it. Right, Maria?
Well,
that would be a good thing
you
to talk about.
You can send me an email at any time at MrBlackHistory@yahoo.com.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you, Chuck Hicks. We'll talk
thank
to you,
you
again soon.
Yes. Thank
right.
you for your time and your activism.
And right, Maria Sanchez,
mm-hmm.
thank you. And is there anything you want to say before we get off the air tonight?
Well, just that with school, they have spring semester started January 7th, but then this past week we had a winter session that's on top of that, that I was at from Sunday until yesterday. And it was so great because it was with classmates and colleagues and the professors. And again, I learned so much, but I miss being on the program. So I apologize for missing last Sunday. I'm working on an independent study on the life and activism of Aretha Franklin this semester. And there was an Aretha Franklin tribute concert in Los Angeles last Sunday that opened with Jennifer Hudson and had Celine Dion and Kelly Clarkson and you name it, on and Harry Belafonte. And it went, it was 3 hours of superstars
wow.
all on one stage honoring the Queen of Soul.
Well, I would like to volunteer to be interviewed because, you know, Aretha Franklin touched me. And
no.
that was one of my great moments. Yes, I was. I'll tell you this story real quick. I was at the Democratic Convention. I was in charge of letting people up on stage, up on the podium, if they didn't have regular access credentials. This young man came up to me. He was Aretha Franklin's son. He said, I need to do a sound check because she was doing the national anthem. I said, of course. We credentialed him and his people. They went up and did a sound check. And then as they were coming off stage after the national anthem, he said to his mother, he was standing, who was walking in front of him, this is the guy that helped us. And she turned around and touched my arm and said, thank you. And just then, Mrs. Brown came around the corner, and I was, like, dancing all over the room. Aretha, touch me! Aretha, touch me! I got touched by Aretha! You know, so it was my it was one of my great moments in politics to actually, for a nanosecond, meet Aretha Franklin, one of my heroes.
Well,
but
I should mention...
we're going to leave you tonight.
But wait,
I'm sorry,
one second.
Go ahead,
I should mention that what I saw last Sunday is going to be televised on CBS in March. So this was the taping of it, and then it's going to be available for everybody on CBS.
Well, that's great, and we'll have to remind people of that as we get closer to it, because
okay.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, it was.
So Maria and I will be back next week, folks.
Yes,
and
we will. And happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day tomorrow.
Yes, and let me leave you, before we leave you with our song, let me leave you with a quote from Dr. King. Commit yourself to the noble struggle of equal rights. You will make a greater person of yourself, a greater nation of your country, and a finer world to live in. And let's try to all remember that. And we leave you tonight, of course, with a song that Stevie Wonder made popular. Happy birthday, Martin. Happy birthday, Martin. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.